some review. We're going to finish up numbers. Today is the plan. All right. Mike, would you mind praying for us? Sure. Should we start it?
Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we are so thankful to be able to have your word and study it, read through it each and every day. We are so thankful to have this space and have this time to better ourselves and to learn from your word. Allow us to be active listeners today through Justin's lesson. Allow us to hear your word and to act upon it through our everyday lives. We thank you for all that you do for us. It's in your sons that we pray.
Amen. Yeah. All right. So chapter 34 is just a bit of geography, and normally I just kind of skip over stuff like this, honestly. But I do want to spend a little bit of time on this just to kind of reinforce some ideas. Sometimes we're not as familiar with the geography as we should be. And as we get into Joshua and then coming into the land, we'll talk more about the Shephelah and the Negev and just the different breakdowns, the coastal plain. Israel is a fascinating place topographically. Just the elevation changes between Jerusalem, the Dead Sea is the lowest spot on Earth, right? Above the ocean, like not Mariana's Trench or anything. Like it is the lowest body of water, and the Sea of Galilee is the lowest freshwater lake in the world. But then you have places like Mount Hermon, Mount Hor, Mount Sinai. So it's just interesting some of the places that are around topographically. We'll look more at that, but just not today. But for today, just want to point out some basics. In Numbers 34, verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the people of Israel, and say to them, when you enter the land of Canaan, this is the land that shall fall to you for an inheritance, the land of Canaan as defined by its borders. Now just pause at this moment. Does anything strike you as interesting, verses 1 through 2, about God giving his people a land that's defined by borders? Maybe it seems obvious. This is not a guess what Justin's thinking, but why does Israel's land need to be defined by borders?
They're just wandering, and there was no definition to where they belonged.
That's right.
So this is giving them a place they belong.
Yes. This is where God can say, you can say about this place, it's mine. It doesn't belong to any other people. It doesn't belong to any other place. Like this is my land. There's some other things about this, too. It belongs to them, not to other people. But what else about Israel? Like, if their area is defined by borders, what's beyond their borders?
Syria,
Babylon. Edom, Moab, right? There are other lands that God says, that's not your territory. And so God's not just concerned for Israel as a nation. He actually has concern for other nations. And I find that really interesting. God doesn't just say, wherever you conquer is fine with me. Just go in, mark out your territory, it's yours. He says, this is yours. And so God's kind of giving, like, the big brother, like, this is your room. Okay, keep your stuff nice and neat, but don't go into your brother's room and take his stuff. That's kind of what's happening here. So God is giving his people a defined borders. In verse 3, your south side shall be from the wilderness of Zin alongside Edom. Again, you've got another nation. And your southern border shall run from the end of the Salt Sea on the east. And your border shall turn south of the ascent of Akrabim and cross to Zin, and its limit shall be south of Kadesh Barnea. Then it shall go on to Hazar Adar and pass along to Asmon. And the border shall turn from Asmon to the brook of Egypt, and its limit shall be at the sea. All right? So you've got these territories. There's nothing special here about what I'm about to do. But this, of course, is body of water. Anybody remember what that is? On the right side? Mm-hmm. Let me go back up to the previous one. What's this body of water here on the right?
Dead Sea.
Nope, not Sea of Galilee. Sea of Galilee is up north. We'll look at that in a second. This is a modern map, so the Dead Sea is going to look a little different than it did 3,000 years ago. I don't know what it looked like exactly 3,000 years ago, but that's the Salt Sea. That's the Dead Sea. And all this stuff down here, like they're doing stuff with it today. It's actually drying up. The Salt Sea is drying up. You know, whatever, climate change, or they're just using up the Jordan River, however you want to mix that up. But like, that's the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea. Okay, both names are fine. And so this body of water over here?
Mediterranean Sea,
also known as the, in the text, it's known as the what? Numbers 34. Look at verse 6.
The Great Sea.
The Great Sea. Mediterranean. Anybody know what the word Mediterranean means? Yeah, exactly. It's the sea in the middle of the earth. Terrain, like terra firma, right? Solid ground, solid earth. And med, like medium-sized shirt, right? Like it's the middle of choice. Like it's the middle sea. So it's the Great Sea. So when they think about the sea, the ocean, the waters, like this is as big as it gets in their mind, okay? So you've got the Great Sea, the Dead Sea, and these are going to be major markers in their territory. Now, there's some other places in the Bible that define the territory a little bit differently. We're just looking at Numbers 34. But the Dead Sea, Salt Sea, I've intentionally chosen a map that doesn't have anything labeled. Because there's something that happens to my brain when I look at labels, I don't learn anything. I go, oh yeah, the label's there, I can read the label. But we'll try to learn it without the labels. Mediterranean Sea, Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea. Now, as we move south, he says the border is to pass south of the ascent of Akrabim. Akrabim means scorpion, for what that's worth. So it's the path of the scorpion. It sounds like some kind of, like, episode 2, the ascent of the scorpion. Okay. But that's a place, it's just north of Petra. Okay, so modern-day Petra, ancient Petra, which belonged to Edom. So they're passing along the border of the nation of Edom. Edom is going to be their boundary to the south. Now, this is not exact, okay? I Googled different things, and I found that's about where the ascent of Akrabim is. Plopping that there. I'm not showing you anything west. But it's going to go towards Zin. Now, where is Zin? If you look at a map, if you have a map in the back of your Bible, it's just the wilderness of Zin, which is not the same as the wilderness of Sin, which is like the wilderness of Sinai. But Zin is a separate place. There's an area known as the Wilderness of Zin, and they're going to come down that way and then back up kind of north and west to the Brook of Egypt. Now, don't think Nile River. It's not Nile River. There's actually a brook that empties out into the Mediterranean Sea called the Brook of Egypt, and that's going to be their western border. All right, so far so good? All right, let's head north. And from the Dead Sea up north, what's going to be their border on the east side? Not the wilderness, actually. Look at verse 10. You shall draw a line for your eastern border from Hazer Enan to Shepham, and the border shall go down from Shepham to Riblah on the east side of Ain, and the border shall go down and reach to the shoulder of the Sea of Chinneroth on the east, and the border shall go down to the Jordan, and its limit shall be at the Salt Sea. So their border is going to be the Jordan River. So we're kind of moving in opposite direction of what the text shows. But the Jordan River is going to be their border on the east. Now, there's an exception to this. God's giving them some extra land. But this is the border as it contains on the east. Border on the west side is what? The Great Sea, the Mediterranean Sea. Border on the east side is the Jordan River. Now, beyond that is some territory that is now going to be included because of what tribes? What tribes are over on the east side? Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. So if you look back at chapter 32, Reuben and Gad and then half the tribe of Manasseh are going to settle over on the east side. So part of that is going to be included. Now that's in the northern area, not on the southern area. I'm intentionally not showing you a map that has it all blocked out because I want us to kind of discover it for ourselves. But it's going to be on the eastern side of the Jordan toward the north. But the Jordan River is going to be their border, all right? So far, so good? Now, this makes it up to the body of water to the north of the Jordan River. And what body of water is that? Galilean Sea. Here is called the Sea of Shinaroth, right. And it also has some other names, Lake Tiberias. So like it's got several names, okay, for the Sea of Galilee or Lake Shinaroth. And that's this border here. Now, anybody know what this is? This area here? There's a mountain there that's going to be kind of important. What did you say?
Mount Carmel.
Mount Carmel, you say the modern name?
Yeah.
Yeah. These names, there are biblical names and there are modern names. But the biblical name is Mount Carmel. What happened on Mount Carmel?
Elijah.
Tell us about it.
Elijah defeated the prophets of Baal as well as Baal.
Yes, so God sends fire down, consumes the offering, the wood, the water, the altar, even the ground itself right there on Mount Carmel. It's a contest between God and Baal, right? So that's at Mount Carmel. So from Mount Carmel, you could look down and see the Sea of Galilee, but you're right there by the Great Sea, right? Now the border, God gives them a border that stretches from the Great Sea over to, let me get back in Numbers 34. Look at verse 7. This shall be your northern border from the Great Sea, shall join a line to Mount Hor. Now there are two Mount Hors in the Bible. There's a southern Mount Hor and there's a northern Mount Hor. When Aaron dies, he's buried on Mount Hor. But that's south. This is the northern Mount Hor. And so they draw a line to Mount Hor. It's in the Lebanese mountains. Okay, so it's the southern border of Lebanon. Okay, and Lebanon is going to be a biblical nation that Israel is going to interact with. In fact, Lebanon is going to help them in the building of the temple. You've got Hiram, king of Tyre. You've got the cedars of Lebanon, right? Does that ring a bell? Cedars of Lebanon. So these are territories, nations that are going to have some interaction with Israel. But they draw this line from the sea to Mount Hor and then to Lebo Hamath. And that's past our map here. I'm just kind of giving you a brief. But there's kind of this lump on the right side that is this border. And depending on which text you're looking at, the lump is bigger or smaller. It just depends on what you're looking at. But then there's this section down here in Gilead where Reuben, Gad, half-tribe of Manasseh is settled. Right? So far, so good? Nothing complicated about this. We want to introduce that. We're going to be talking more about geography when we get into Joshua because we've not been spending much time in the land of Canaan itself. But it's important just to kind of have an idea of what is the Shephelah and what is the coastal plain and, you know, what is this path that, you know, when David meets Goliath, for example, in 1 Samuel, they're fighting in a particular area that's an important place where they travel through. It is a valley that would funnel all of the travel between Philistia and Judea. So there's a reason they're having a battle in that valley. So understanding some of the geography can help with that. Any thoughts or questions so far? All right. Good. We're going to black that out for now. Don't even worry about that. Let's continue to read in chapter 34. And Elijah? To know that, and I don't recall.
Is it New Jersey?
I wanted to say it's about the size of New Jersey. It's smaller than Indiana. Yeah. It's Israel is a tiny place. Like, you start thinking about how quick it is to get from place to place. Now, they're walking on foot, but still, this is not like they're going on an epic journey from Galilee to Jerusalem. It takes them months to get there. It's like a 6-day stroll from Galilee to Jerusalem. Someone's Googling it in the back, and that's.
Yeah, I pulled it up. It's.
I think New Jersey. About the size of New Jersey, isn't it?
It's probably about the size of New Jersey. It's taller.
They put it next to
Vermont, Massachusetts.
Oh, who knows what Vermont is?
Probably about the size of Vermont or New Jersey.
Yeah, it's small. Yeah, good question. All right, other thoughts or questions? Chris, good? All right, Amos?
I was thinking that the people of Israel is a big nation, so does God manage to fit them all into a small area?
Yes. Yeah, fitting them into this area is not going to be a problem. Yeah. Israel at this point, about 2 million people, give or take, we're not sure. We're only told the number of fighting men, but getting them into the land, they're going to have a lot of land. In fact, God's going to tell them in Deuteronomy that he's not going to drive out all the nations at once. Because if he does, you know what happens if you move into a house and no one's lived there for a long time? What happens? I'm sorry? Well, yeah, you have to work on it a lot, but what else? Linda? Okay. Rot, what else? What happens to your pipes? If water's just been sitting there, right? Now, that's not happening in Israel, but like rodents, right? So God doesn't want the land to be overrun by wild beasts. If people move out of territory, then he says, I'll make sure that doesn't happen. And so he's allowing people to stay in the land, kind of continue to occupy while Israel moves in and slowly drives out the inhabitants. All right. Now, I'm going to leave that there, and let's look at chapter 34, 16 through 29. God lists the chiefs of each tribe. Verse 29, these are the men the Lord commanded to divide the inheritance for the people of Israel in the land of Canaan. Now, let's spend a little bit of time here in chapter 35, and can I get a volunteer to read 1 through 8? Amos, nice and loud.
The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, command the people of Israel to give to the Levites some of the inheritance of their possession as cities for them to dwell in. And you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to dwell in, and their pasture lands shall be for their cattle, for their livestock, and for all their beasts. The pasture lands of the cities which you shall give up to the Levites shall reach from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits all around. And you shall measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, the city being in the middle. This shall belong to them as pasture land for their cities. The cities that you give to the Levites shall be the 6 cities of refuge, where you shall permit the manslayer to flee. And in addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. All the cities that you give to the Levites shall be 48, with their pasture lands. And as for the cities that you shall give from the possessions of the people of Israel, from the larger tribes you shall take many. From the smaller tribes you shall take few, each in proportion to the inheritance that it inherits shall give of the cities to the Levites.
All right, so there are 12 tribes of Israel, but that's kind of one way to look at it. There are also 13 tribes of Israel. Now, why are there 12 sons of Jacob but 13 tribes? What happened? That's right, Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph is the bountiful bough in Genesis 49, and he gets the double portion. Jacob treats him as the firstborn. And remember, he blesses Ephraim and Manasseh, crosses his hands, and Ephraim is the younger of the two, but he blesses him first and becomes the greater of those two tribes. So Joseph now represents two tribes. Well, there will only be 12 territories. So what does Levi do? Well, Levi is going to not inherit land. They're going to inherit the Lord. God says, I'm going to be their inheritance. We saw that in the book of Leviticus. But they still need a place to live. So God provides them cities to live in. 48 cities. And the cities are scattered all throughout Israel's territory. Now, this is really important. I want you to look back at Genesis 49. This is actually in fulfillment of a prophecy. Jacob had prophesied to his sons in Genesis 49, verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. And that refers to them, remember, Simeon and Levi, they went and like struck down the whole city of Shechem because you shouldn't treat our sister Dinah that way. And so in verse 7, he says, cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So Levi is going to be scattered in Israel. Simeon is also going to be scattered in Israel for a different reason. But Levi is going to be scattered in Israel. Why would it be important for the Levites to have territory all throughout the land? I'm sorry, can you say it one more?
So make the sacrifices and things that need to be scattered.
Yeah, they're going to have this spiritual influence in that way. Kind of, when you salt your food, you don't just like throw a lump of salt in and say, well, salt it. Like you incorporate it. Now, they're not going to be scattered around so that they can help necessarily offer sacrifices in those places, because all the sacrifices are going to be made where? In Jerusalem, there at the temple or the tabernacle at Shiloh. It's going to be in different places, at Ramah later. And so you've got a central location for worship, but the Levites are going to be scattered around for their influence. The Levites are going to be teachers. One of the main jobs of the Levites is, again, you could summarize it as they are mediators. So they're leading in worship, they're leading in sacrifice, but they're also teaching the people God's law. So the Levites are meant to be these influences among the people. But there's another really important reason why they need to be scattered around. There are six cities among these 48. And these six cities are known as cities of refuge. So they get the city, and they get a certain territory all around that goes with it for farmland, pasture, and that's their little chunk. Okay? But these six cities are going to be scattered around so that everyone has equal access to them, cities of refuge. We've not read what those are about yet. But so far, so good. Then let's look at 9 through 21 here. Elijah, would you read that, please? 9 through 21. All right, so there are these places where, this is really interesting, these places that would be safe places for someone who had committed, not murder maybe, but what would we call it today?
Manslaughter.
So you accidentally kill someone. Now, if it's an accident, does it count?
Yes.
That's to that person. And it does to who else? Family. So if, I don't know, if Mike and I are over here and we're working together, and then we're up on the roof and he's down and we're working, and I grab a stack of shingles and they slip and fall, land on his neck, he's gone. Sorry, Mike. I didn't take it up and throw it at him. There's no evidence of that immediately, but still, Mike's laying there, he's dead. And Justin is, for this purpose, the next of kin. He hears about it. He's got a job to do. What's his job? Justice, right? And so he's going to come hunting me down. What option do I have?
Run!
Get a lawyer? No, you run. You run. And I've got a city to run to, a city of refuge. Do you see why now it's important that they be scattered evenly through the territory? If they're all up north, I've got a problem. I'm down here in the Negev, and they're up, in the heights of Golan. I'm in trouble, okay? I've got to run all the way up to Lebo Hamath to get up to, this is not going well for me, and Justin has got a job to do, okay? So I'm going to get to the city of refuge. Now, if I'm in the city of refuge, and it turns out that, a stack of shingles, sure, you took a hammer and you threw it at him. where you took a hammer and you hit him with it. And suddenly you look at the tool that was used, or the item that was used for the killing, and it says if it's an iron object, if it's a stone object, if it's a wooden object that could kill, that kind of settles it. Like, there was intent behind this. You chose an object that could kill someone, killed them dead, and so he's going to execute me. Now, what does that make Justin? An avenger. Is he a murderer? Justin's not a murderer. This is about justice. This is about righteousness. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. So this is about justice. And so it gives an opportunity for someone who's professing innocence to come into a city and find shelter until justice can be determined. Amos? Can you speak up a little bit for me?
Why does it list specific materials?
It's giving these as examples of the kinds of things you need to be looking for if you're going to determine, was this an accident, manslaughter, there's still a death, or was this murder, an intention? You know? So again, if I'm slinging hay, right, and there was a rock in it, hits him, that's an accident. But if I take my fork and I throw it at him, my hay fork, okay, that could kill someone. That's not an accident. It's a different thing. Okay? These are examples of the kinds of things you're looking for as you're trying to determine justice. God doesn't leave it to the people to say, yeah, whatever you think is good. Do you remember what happened in Genesis chapter 4 when someone said, yeah, I'll take justice into my own hands? Lamech. Some guy insulted him. And so, yeah. Cain's vengeance is sevenfold, Lamech's is 77-fold. It doesn't work that way. And so God's going to limit this kind of aggression and say, this is justice and no more. Now, let's keep looking at this to kind of see how the rest of this unfolds. In verse 22, but if he pushed him suddenly, without enmity, or hurled anything on him without lying in wait, again, like the rock or the shingles, or used a stone that could cause death, and without seeing him dropped it on him so that he died, oh, he was not his enemy and did not seek his harm. Yeah, I heard Justin and Mike the other day. They were having some harsh words. Well, nothing like that had happened. So there's no animosity beforehand. Verse 24, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood in accordance with these rules. And the congregation shall rescue the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood. And the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he had fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the boundaries of his city of refuge to which he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the boundaries of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood, for he must remain in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. And these things shall be for statute and rules for you throughout your generation in all your dwelling places. And can I get a volunteer to read 30 through 34? Thank you.
If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witnesses. But no person shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. Moreover, you shall not accept a ransom for the life of a murderer who is condemned to death, but he must be put to death. And you shall not accept a ransom for one who has fled to his city of refuge, so that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not defile the land in which you live, for blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of the one who shed it. So you shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel.
All right, so get together, and the person who did the killing, find out it was intentional, it's murder. What's the proper response?
Killing.
Execution, right? And that goes back to Genesis chapter 10, chapter 8. When Noah comes off the ark, God says, by man shall man's blood be shed. So if someone kills someone, the proper response is this equal justice. Capital punishment is taught in the Bible. I'm not making any kind of political statements about that, but this is about justice. So life for a life, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, there's a justice there. You don't hunt the person's family down and carry on a generational grudge, Hatfield McCoy style, and just start killing a bunch of people. He took me out, I'm going to take him and his brother out. Like, it doesn't work that way. I don't know where the New Jersey accent came from, sorry. But that, you don't do that, right? So this is justice. Now, if you take this person, and one person comes along and says, yeah, I saw him. They were having this conflict, and he took the rock, and he threw it at him hard. He was trying to kill him. And only one person's witness. What now? How many witnesses do you need? You need at least two witnesses, two or three witnesses. So there's a testimony here. There's a safeguard at work here. If he's found to be innocent of murder, then what's to be his fate? So, regardless of where his home is, the city of refuge becomes his home until the high priest who's currently serving dies. When that current high priest dies, he's released from his penalty of death. Wait, I thought he's not guilty. Why does he have to stay? I'm sorry, speak up.
Otherwise,
the Avenger's still going to kill him if he gets out, but why? Amos? It is a consequence. Why does he need to bear a consequence? Whether it was intentional or not, blood was shed. A life was taken, and so a life must be given. Now, in his case, and this is a really interesting thing, his life is going to be given by living in the city of refuge. He's going to find new work, a new life there, and he's going to spend his time. It may be a week. It may be a couple of decades. It all depends on what? Life of the high priest. And when the high priest dies, a life was taken, a life must be given, but now a life is given by the high priest in his stead, and he is released. Linda? Because the Avenger is not going to bear that consequence for him. He's going to take the life. But it's not like I'm scared of the Avenger. It's not fear of the Avenger that's keeping him in the city. It's the consequence of taking the life. But when the high priest dies, it's as though he's going to bear the consequences of what he had done. Now, does that remind you of anything at all? When the high priest dies, then this person is set free. Some sins that we commit, like we choose to intentionally go that way. Like we're seeking evil, we're doing evil, we've sinned. There are other sins that we commit that we just do them. Like, we shoved someone and didn't, like, I wasn't thinking about it, I was angry. Hurled some nasty words at my spouse, wasn't thinking about it, I was just angry. And you just did this thing. You inconvenienced someone. You didn't keep your word because you forgot. Okay, I was talking with someone recently, and they got busy doing something. And then they realize, oh my, I was supposed to watch my brother's son, and now I've run out of time and run out of energy, and I got to text him and say I can't go. Well, you gave him his word. Now, did you mean to break your promise? No. Well, what does that count? Is it you didn't mean to. No, it still counts. There are still consequences to be born. And so what we're seeing here is God cares about these consequences. He cares about righteousness. And he says, if you don't tend to this, then what happens to the land? Look at verse 35 and verse 34. The land is defiled. It's polluted. Now, interesting, in Ezekiel, God comforts the land. Kind of a weird passage. We'll look at it later. But the land of Canaan is sort of personified, anthropomorphized, however you say that. It's like the mountains are crying. It's like, nobody wants to live in us. You know, we're getting this bad reputation because it's almost like Canaan, the land of Canaan, becomes this nation or this land that spews out the nations. The Jebusites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, all those nations lived there in the land, and because of their wickedness, they were cast out of the land. Then Israel comes and lives in the land, and because of their wickedness, they're cast out of the land. The land is polluted because of sin. And so Canaan, this land, is seen as kind of weeping and crying because the land has been polluted by their sin. And God says, I want to comfort you and bring righteousness back into this land. God cares about what happens. When Cain kills Abel, what does God hear? From the earth. I want you to try for a moment to see the world the way God sees it. In Romans chapter 8, we're told that all creation is groaning because it wants to be set free from the pains of childbirth. Romans 8 and verse 20 says it was subjected to futility. It is longing to be set free from bondage. And in verse 22, it's groaning. The world is suffering under this pollution of sin. And God sees the marks of it everywhere. And he says, I want this land, if I want to dwell with you in the land, it has to be free from sin. It's got to be free from the pollution of iniquity. Are they standing out there waiting?
No, not our people.
All right. Stacy. Yes.
You know, Ahab's whole family was taken out.
Right.
So, do they still have those cities that were, is this different because there's a time of judges versus a time of kings? Do they still have those things set up?
They were supposed to. There are a lot of things that are getting set up here in Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy that there's not much evidence for them actually doing later. In fact, when you read in Nehemiah, it talks about them celebrating the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, and it says that they had not done that since the days of Joshua. Some laws are, in fact, Philadelphia probably has some city laws that we don't pay attention to. I found all kinds of weird, like spitting in front of a woman in certain cities in Oklahoma will get you in jail for 24 hours. Nobody counts that law anymore. And I think the Israelites begin to see laws like this, kind of like that. Now, you do see some of this in practice when Naboth, Ahab, you mentioned Ahab, when Ahab wants Naboth's vineyard and they falsely accuse Naboth, they have two witnesses. They make sure they have their two witnesses. And it comes back to stuff like this. Or when Ahab wants Ramoth-Gilead back, Ramoth-Gilead is going to be one of these cities of refuge. And so there may be some reason why he wants that one back specifically. So there's some of that in play, but you never see them actually practicing this, unfortunately. It's a good question.
So back to previously, talking about how you don't want to leave the land and have it overtaken by beasts and stuff like that. So say if something happens, it's innocent or guilty or whatever, he flees to a refugee camp, but I'm assuming his family, if he's married, kids will go with him. What would happen to that land? Would it just kind of like, would it just be
divvied
up? Or is essentially he could be in refuge for, 10?
Yeah, he could be in the city of refuge for a long time. Yeah, I don't know if he's going to live there on his own, and his family's going to stay behind. And he's the only one who's under threat of the Avenger. So the Avenger can't go after his son or his wife or any of that. So I don't know how that works. I'm sure that they would make sure, his family, you still have the Redeemer, and you still have the year of Jubilee where the land goes back to its previous owner. So all that's still in effect. It's a huge inconvenience. It's absolutely a huge inconvenience. But it's a consequence that has to be borne because of the action taken. It's a good question. Chris?
Does this apply to manslaughter?
Yeah, I think it falls into that as well, yeah. Yeah, there's some particulars about that I don't know. But, yeah, he can't be counted as a murderer unless there are two or three witnesses. So this consequence is still pretty severe, but at least he's not killed for it.
And then when David gives Saul his hit list, he's dying, and that guy who threw rocks at him,
right, Shimei. Right.
That strikes me as a similar situation.
Very
similar. Jerusalem was not actually a city.
Jerusalem was not one of these cities of Levi. Right. It was not a refuge city. But it's kind of the same practice, is what you're saying. Yeah, that's exactly right. Elijah?
Where would the guy live in the city's refuge? He doesn't have a portion of land allotted to him. That's his.
They're going to have to figure that out. Like he's going to have to rent a hut, or buy a house, or build a house, or something's going to have to figure something out. And the Levites were meant to provide this kind of safe place. It wasn't like these cities of refuge, that was their job. The Levites who lived it, that was their job, was to maintain the city of refuge. And one of the reasons they're going to need to do this is because it could happen to them. You know, they might need refuge, too. But back to Stacy's question, I don't know that you see this happening in the history of Israel, which is sad. If they had followed this, then it's going to protect the people from the pollution of sin over a long time. Amos?
Would it count as murder if the avenger of blood comes into the city and kills the high priest so that they let...
Well, there you've got another... Like, you just killed the high priest, so what is that?
Another murder?
Yes, another murder. He's going to be in trouble. Yeah. That's not justice, that's personal vengeance. So, the Avenger of Blood is not doing wrong by seeking vengeance, but it's not personal vengeance. It can't be just for purely personal reasons. All right, chapter 36. Anyway, one of the things I want you to see here is how the cities of refuge set up this idea that life is important, that the lifeblood is important, and that an exchange can be made. However, they can't say, well, I want this guy to get out early, we'll pay a ransom, and he can leave the city of refuge early. The only exchange that stands is life. And in this case, it's the life of the high priest. So the only life that can be exchanged in this case is the life of the high priest, and that sets us up for seeing Jesus more clearly later. Grace? Okay. Chapter 36, we've kind of already touched on back when we looked at Numbers 27, the daughters of Zelophehad. They are eager to have this inheritance for their future generations. God's people, in this noble way, want to secure an inheritance. They care about being God's people. Next time, we're going to look at Deuteronomy, but that's all we have time for today. Really appreciate you guys stepping into this. I'm going to send out some handouts or study guides for Deuteronomy so we can be ready for that. But that's it. That's it for today. So thank you for spending your Lord's Day with us.